Welcome to State of the State, where we put Michigan's policy issues in national and historical context and apply research to the state's top problems. I'm Matt Grossman, director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research and a political scientist at MSU. I'm joined by my co-host, economist and State of the State survey director, Dr. Charlie Ballard. But today, Charlie's outnumbered, as our guest is another political scientist and director of MSU's public policy program, Dr. Josh Sapochny. Josh is an expert on local government and state-local relations, so today we'll talk state preemption laws and local government legacy costs. Let's start with preemption. Josh, what is it, and where is the state preempting the locals?
So thanks, Matt, and thanks for having me, you guys. Preemption is essentially the use of a state law or even a provision in the state constitution that nullifies a municipal ordinance or a municipal authority in a particular issue area. So this has become a fairly hot topic nationally, and Michigan is sort of no exception here. There's a whole range of issue areas where the state is either considering laws that would make local action illegal, or impose a serious barrier to it, or issue areas where they've passed this legislation. Maybe the most high profile case is the plastic bag ban. So it's actually banning the ban. So Washtenaw County imposed a 10-cent tax on disposable plastic bags, and the state of Michigan, a few months later, state legislature stepped in and said, actually, that's not going to be legal, not only for you, Washtenaw County, but for any municipality in the state. And there's a whole range of other areas. It's an environmental regulation, firearm use, labor laws. Michigan has on its currently on its agenda. It has a short-term vacation rentals bill that we can maybe talk a little bit about. A sanctuary city bill on the agenda, and then there's been at least three pieces of legislation passed in the last few years around soda and food taxes. So local governments no longer have the ability to impose a tax on food or soda. There's a living and prevailing wage law from 2015 that bars local governments, actually bars additional local governments. So the local governments who have a sort of minimum wage or living wage, prevailing wage law can keep it, but it bars additional local governments from imposing those sorts of wage laws, and there's a range of others as well. Fracking is on the legislative agenda. There's an LGBT rights protection bill that's on the legislative agenda. So this is something that's taking hold in Michigan, it's a pretty interesting issue area. I think there's a lot of interesting politics going on here that I'm excited to talk about with you.
And Charlie, there's an irony in who's complaining about overreach from the higher levels of government.
Well, in a lot of states, what's going on is it's Republican-controlled legislatures and governors who are restricting the ability of local governments that are Democratic. And those same state-level officials, in many cases, complain loudly about federal overreach, about regulations imposed by the federal government. So they're against overreach by the federal relative to the state, but they're okay with overreach by the state relative to the localities. In other words, it's not a sort of a consistent view of federalism that says that the higher level is always better or the higher level is always worse. Rather, it's just that these are political issues where these folks want to have a particular outcome. Interestingly, Josh was talking about several of these have to do with revenue raising. Local governments are looking to find money. They're strapped for money for one reason. One reason for that is that the state government has cut back very substantially on its revenue sharing payments. And there are also a variety of other ways in which local governments in Michigan are strapped in terms of their ability to raise revenue. And so that puts the county commissioners and the city council and all of those folks in a very difficult place.
And what is the context here for state-local relations in Michigan, Josh?
Yeah, so the United States Constitution doesn't mention municipal governments or city governments, any sort of local government below the state level. So what that means for local governments across the country, not just in Michigan, is that the state constitution and the state the laws that the state passes sets the rules of the game for local governments. So the authority that they have to raise their own revenue, raise certain types of revenue, property tax versus income tax versus sales tax, these are decisions that the state makes. How revenue sharing payments are made to local governments, or how that revenue is distributed, those are decisions that are made by the state. And as you know, as we, where we started with preemption, these are, you know, this is well within the rights of the state government to behave this way. A lot of folks are sort of, there's a lot of grumbling and a lot of complaining, but to a certain extent, this is the nature of U.S. federalism. It's the nature of the way that our system's set up structurally.
But Michigan in particular has been a little tougher on local governments.
Michigan has been a little tougher on local governments. Yeah, it seems this state seems to be ground zero for policies that are particularly restrictive or particularly punitive on local governments. So the preemption sort of movement is taking hold currently. In the last few years, there's been state preemption laws in a range of areas that I just mentioned. But historically, as Charlie was alluding to, from a fiscal standpoint, this state has layered restrictive policy on top of restricted policy for the last 40 odd years, starting in the late 1970s with the Headley Amendment, in the mid 90s with Proposal A. We have an emergency manager policy that's incredibly restrictive. If you know, there's no greater area. If you're trying to get a sense of how this state government thinks about its local governments, than the emergency manager policy. So it's, you appoint one individual. That individual has control over running the entire city with limited staff. Right. So embedded in that sort of design, that policy design, is a sense of what, you know, the state government's view of local governments, the importance of local governments, the role of local governments. And I mean, the sort of the punchline is the state doesn't think very much of local governments. And the degree to which the state does think about local governments, it's sort of getting cranky about things that they're doing and responding fairly forcefully.
I do think there is something new in the preemption debate, which first of all is about kind of organizing on both sides. We do have geographic polarization. Democrats are increasingly concentrated in cities, Republicans in outlying areas, and that means that there's a lot of places where the Democrats control a lot of cities and college towns, but the Republicans control the state government. And there always was this kind of corridor of ordinances that go from Berkeley, California to Madison, Wisconsin to Ann Arbor, Michigan. But that network is getting a lot more active across a lot more issue areas to try to push liberal policies at the local level. And at the same time, there's a lot of organizing at the state level by Republicans and conservatives. A lot of these state preemption laws come out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, where they write model bills in one state that can be passed just by changing a few state names and other things in other states. And preemption has become a big focus of them, in part because companies who want to see, or chambers of commerce that want to see changes, are sort of venue shopping and saying, well, we can't really stop Berkeley or Ann Arbor, but we can go to the higher level and play to win there.
Would you say, Josh, that Michigan is one of the most, or perhaps the most, restrictive in terms of state legislative approaches to what local governments can do?
Yes, I would say that. Certainly on the fiscal side, and that's a finding from a research project it's sort of ongoing. But in terms of tax and expenditure limits, as I mentioned, Proposal A, right, and the Headley Amendment, which, without getting too technical, in concert means that During the Great Recession, after the Great Recession, local governments can lose a lot of property tax revenue generating power. But as the economy improves, the state sort of restricts their ability to improve with the economy, with the objective economic indicators.
Bring revenue back.
That's right, to bring the revenue back.
Yes.
So that is certainly the case. And then the state's revenue sharing policy is restrictive as well. There's constitutionally protected revenue sharing, but beyond that, the locals have to rely on sort of legislative processes, the discretion of the state legislature to make good on promises that were made historically, and they tend to not make good on those promises if given the opportunity.
In a sense, the state is solving its fiscal problems by pushing those fiscal problems down to the local governments.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And
now, Josh, you mentioned that the Airbnb case may kind of get us out of this conservative states and liberal locals dynamic. Is that right? What's happening there?
Yeah. So the short-term vacation rental preemption debate that's happening at the state level right now. What happened was, and this is Grand Haven is the case that's getting a lot of play, but Traverse City has had passed restrictions on the number of short-term rentals in residential neighborhoods. Spring Lake Township in Ottawa County did, and St. Joseph did as well. So there's something that holds these local communities together. There's an affluence. These are places that have that are relatively wealthy local communities. And they can serve as sort of vacation destinations for Michiganders and other folks in the Midwest. So like I said, so Grand Haven passes city council passes a restriction on the number of short term rentals in two specific residential neighborhoods, and so the complaint that was being made is that these short term rentals were changing the character. Or sort of the feel of the neighborhood, and
to be hurting the hotel industry as well.
That's true. That is absolutely right. And so, to your point about these sort of the lobbying arms of these organizations taking advantage of the state's ability to step in. There are significant lobbying efforts on behalf of the hotel industry at the state level, and so the piece of legislation that's being debated right now is basically making that illegal, right? So you can't restrict these short-term rentals in your communities. So it's one in a long line of examples of preemption. But what's interesting about it is this is not a traditional red state, blue city type of issue. These are nonpartisan elections, but these are relatively affluent areas. And it doesn't sort of easily organize along partisan lines.
So sort of strange political bedfellows.
Strange political
Do you have a prediction about how this one is going to work out?
I think it's going to pass.
All right.
I think it's going to pass. I think the preemption movement has really taken over. And a part of the reason why is that there's not much of a presence for local governments in state government, so there's no sort of there's no agency that houses local government issues. They're spread out across a range of agencies, so there's they don't have a seat at the table when these decisions are being made.
But Charlie, you noticed that there's not complete agreement when it comes to the local data on where they stand on this issue. They're against it in principle, but maybe not in practice.
Right. The Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan does regular surveys of local officials, and they found in a recent survey that 70% of local officials, or at least 70% of the officials whom they were able to get responses from, believe that the state is taking too much from them in terms of power to make certain decisions. But then when they ask about certain hot-button particular issues, many of these local officials would, in fact, defer to the state on LGBT issues, on the minimum wage, on the plastic bag ban, and so on. It sort of reminds me of the well-established regularity in public opinion research that most people hate Congress but like their own congressman. It's sort of the general and the particular don't always line up.
Right.
And another issue where local governments might both fear state overreach but might secretly kind of want the state to force their actions is on the increasing retiree obligations that local governments have. And that is a hot issue in Michigan right now. The police and fire unions started protesting before the latest bill was introduced. But the legislature last year at this time tried to take action on this issue, kind of got shot down. The governor in the interim established a commission to deal with it over the summer, they reported, and now they're back at it at the end of the year trying to address this. The context here is that we have all these other obligations that local governments have made to their retirees, and it's mostly in the area of health, which is not constitutionally guaranteed, whereas the pension benefits are by the state. So that means that this is kind of the area where the state can try to force the locals to make some changes. Charlie, how did we get in this situation in the first place, and how much have we been telling people in advance what we're going to pay for?
Well, this is a huge issue nationwide in every state and with the federal government. What we have here, I don't want to get too technical, but you sort of have to get a little bit technical, are defined benefits. A defined benefit plan is one where the law says at some point in the future, you, the recipient, the person, is going to receive a particular amount of money or a particular health care benefit. That contrasts with 401ks and other plans, which are what we call defined contribution, where you just put in money right now, and then how much you get out when you're retired would depend upon how well your investments do. So a defined contribution, it's always in balance. Whereas defined benefit plans, if you make a promise now that your local government or your company, for that matter, will pay something 30 years from now, well, we don't really know whether you'll have the money. And it's really easy politically, of course, for the city council, for the state legislature to make promises now, or let's go back, it's 1975. We're going to make promises that we'll pay you in 2017. That was easy because, of course, those elected officials won't be around when the bill comes due. And, for instance, if you look at the city of Detroit, and it's very similar, actually, to General Motors, they made promises long ago that if Detroit had not shrunk from 2 million people to 700,000 people, they probably would have still had the financial wherewithal to meet those obligations. If GM had maintained its market share, they probably could have paid them. But of course, we have seen that shrinkage of Detroit. We've seen that shrinkage of GM. And that's something that's very difficult to predict 40 years into the future.
And it's the same thing in health, where we can tell people in the future, we'll give you this much to pay for your retiree health care, or we can say, we'll pay for 40% of the cost. And it's that latter that's getting Michigan in particular in more trouble. We're actually a little bit lower than normal in pension obligations, but we're quite a bit higher in these other obligations. And how is this affecting local governments in Michigan, Josh? It's not just Detroit.
No, it's not just Detroit. I mean, this is a problem that that almost every local government in this state faces, somewhere on the order of $7 billion of unfunded liability related to healthcare, according to a recent report by MSU Extension. That's an incredible figure.
For local governments.
Yes.
Yeah, a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah, that's real money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to me, this is linked up to the fiscal health of local governments. And, I mean, this is not to the glaze over the eyes of your listeners anymore. But, you know, fiscal health is a really important factor. It's basically the ability to balance revenue and expenditure flows. And if you have to make good on promises that you made, years past, 20, 30 years prior, That's going to affect your ability to provide basic services, police, fire, infrastructure. But even more to the point, it's going to hurt your ability to kind of, you know, craft a forward-looking policy agenda, right? A future, something that you can sort of rally behind, something that's sort of interesting, you know, around placemaking, around, you know, making your community a more vibrant community, a more interesting place to live, a place that could attract business, attract residents. You know, if you're getting hammered on the revenue side as a function of living, right? Living in this state, right? You can't, just like we can't choose our parents, cities can't choose their states. So they have to function in this state. They're getting hit on the revenue side via the tax and expenditure limits and the revenue sharing. And now you have all these pension and OPEB obligations on top of that. It's rough. It's hard to be a city in this state. Hard to be a mayor and a city council member in this state. Sorry.
And even the high-end cities are paying like 70 or 80% of these obligations.
Right.
A lot of local ones are only paying 30 or 40% funded so far in these obligations. So how did we get out of this in Detroit, Charlie? And is it at all have lessons for other cities?
Well, we got out of it in Detroit through the grand bargain, where private funds were made available and where basically everybody took a little bit of a hit. The retirees did not get 100% of what they were promised. The creditors did not get 100% of what they promised. And I have to tell you that Judge Rhodes, Stephen Rhodes, who managed that bankruptcy, performed what I would consider nearly a miracle. Frankly, when Detroit went into that proceeding, I was not that optimistic that it would end as neatly as it has. And in particular, Judge Rhodes managed to get the bankruptcy through in such a way that the Detroit Institute of the Arts did not have to auction off its Van Gogh or its Bruegel. And that, for me, that's a great thing. But as I say, that was a very remarkable set of events. And so if we can duplicate that in other places, that would be great. But I'm suggesting that it wouldn't be easy, because every municipality that's in trouble has its own unique culture and its own unique set of circumstances. And I think we're going to be fighting these battles, not just in Michigan, but all across the country for a very long time.
And Josh, the state seems to be seeing a nail and using the same hammer here. We're going back to an emergency manager type process. We got four rounds of back and forth between state and local governments being portrayed. And in the end, the idea is the same, that the state will sort of take it over and work out between the local unions. So where do you see this going?
Yeah, to a certain extent, that's right. So you said the four rounds, and then the fifth round is, if they can't come to an agreement, is okay. Well, the state's going to figure this out. But the mechanism or the instrument for working this out is very different. So, an emergency manager, this is an approach unlike any other intervention in fiscally distressed cities that we see around the country. The emergency manager policy is just just otherworldly in how much power the emergency manager is given. And how little help local governments are given on the revenue side, right? All the extraordinary powers that the emergency manager is given is on the spending side, and their ability to take on contracts. But this fifth round that you're mentioning, this is more of a board structure. It's a three-person board. The local.
So they've learned something.
They've learned, yeah. I think that's the idea, is that the Treasury, the state legislature, I think it's mostly coming out of Treasury, the local government division out of Treasury. And I've been involved in some of those conversations. There's been a lot of discussion with people in very similar positions around the country. And you know, one of the things that you sort of notice in those meetings is people's faces when you talk about our emergency manager policy to folks in similar positions around the country. They're just like, that's crazy. You know, we couldn't get away with any of that. And this is codified into law here. They've learned. I think that's the punchline. They've learned having local governments represented on the board, I think, is very important. It's less threatening. It's more collaborative. you know, but it's still there's the, it's still a threat that is very credible given the state's history.
So one theory is they're learning. I'll go back to the politics a little bit. We had a very sympathetic police and firefighters at the Capitol Wednesday. They tend to be the most sympathetic local unions. They kind of stared the last bill in the face and won that battle. And I think they're adapting a bit to that. I would point out the research is pretty clear that it is local, strong local unions that do kind of get us into these local governments with a whole bunch of obligations. Unions haven't been winning at the bargaining table as much on underlying wages, but they have been winning on the politically more easy thing of promising benefits in the future since the 70s and 80s. So we've come to the time when we have to tie these issues together. Charlie, you have been strong for a long time on the kind of mismatch here between local needs and abilities.
Yes, I think that's the big story. If you tie together all the pieces of what we've talked about, pity the poor mayor or member of a city council, because the local governments in Michigan are severely restricted in their ability to raise revenue. But that does not mean that they don't have problems, especially some of our poorer communities. I look at Flint, a city that suffered an emergency manager situation, and based on what came out of that, Josh, I hope you're right that we've learned something and that we can do better than we did in Flint, because I would say we didn't do very well in Flint. But Flint is a community, like several in Michigan, that lost a lot of its economic base, lost its local revenue-raising capacity, and our laws are set up in such a way that it didn't have any ability to get more revenue, and the state was pretty Scrooge-ish in this holiday season. I can refer to Scrooge. The state was a Scrooge in terms of the revenue sharing to local governments. That is a very tough bind to be in.
And Josh, this is part of a layering process you mentioned, where we seem to be layering sticks on top of sticks for local governments without a lot of carrots.
That's right. Yeah, if you think about the role of state governments in trying to kind of cajole local governments into meeting their priorities, yes, this state uses almost all sticks and very little carrots. I think there is a connection between these fiscal dynamics and the state's willingness to take on these preemptions in a whole range of areas, and it has a lot to do with there's a lack of a presence for local governments in sort of important state decision making circles. And I think the consequence of that is that you know, I don't think it's malicious. I think some of it is bald-faced partisanship. But I think that a large chunk of this is just there's just no institutional memory. There's no sort of recognition that we've made these choices in the past. We've done Headley. We did Prop A. We did the revenue sharing. Now we had firearm preemption and soda tax bans and all these sorts of things. I just don't think there's much of a recognition that these decisions have been made in the past, and the sum total is, again, a really restrictive environment, not only on the fiscal side, but for the ability of local governments to respond to demands and sort of concerns in their communities.
In a state that has pretty severe legislative term limits, there just isn't anybody in the legislature who has any memory of the processes that led to some of these decisions back in the 70s, 80s, or even the 90s.
Yeah.
But what looks like state-local conflict could be seen as part of a broader ideological battle. There is a question about where to raise the revenues and where to send them, but there's also the question of how much revenue should we raise and how much should we be regulating business. And I think a lot of what looks like a conflict between state-local governments really comes down to a pretty broad debate over the size and scope of government. They may not know what they're doing, but they may know. They may just be in favor of a government that raises a whole lot less revenue than others favor.
To that point, the soda tax ban was strict party line voting. It'd be interesting to see if that's the case with the Airbnb preemption. I don't think it will be. It's going to be more complicated.
Well, thank you for joining us. We are glad to have you with us, and we hope you'll join us next time for the next edition of State of the State. Thank you, Josh, for
being
with us.
Thank you guys very much.
Thanks, Matt. It was fun. Pleasure.